Anthony sure is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas. Death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Shore to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, with criminal defense attorneys Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, Kate Yannick, and Larry Douglas. Huntsville Report outside the death house, Pat Hartwell, and a 20-minute interview with Shore, taped on death row. The execution watch for Anthony Shore begins.
Good evening. It is Thursday on the 18th day of January 2018. My name is Ray Hill. I'm the host of Execution Watch. Tonight, Larry told you earlier, they're killing Anthony Shore. We have a call from Pat. Can you put Pat on the wire? Pat?
Yes. How are you, Ray?
Well, it's a cold, ugly day in Huntsville, Texas.
It's cold and it's ugly in more ways than one anytime the state of Texas executes somebody. And as I'm talking to you right now, I see quite a bit of the press walking across all the three major stations, and Univision is here. Plus we have a Houston Chronicle reporter. We have a reporter from Germany.
All right. So good bit of media tonight. Do we know whether or not there are going to be any witnesses in this case?
I had heard via some rumors there might be, but I don't see anyone except people in black pea coat looking things that reporters wear, so I couldn't tell you. Just a minute, they're crossing right now. It's hard to see in the dark.
Yeah, it's dark up there.
I see. Well, just a minute. Wait till they get up on the steps. And Ray, it is indeed a sad day. We know that Anthony Shore cannot be, we know what he did, but we as human beings, cannot sit around and watch this without saying anything. We're no better than his crimes committed, if we allow ourselves to be complacent with this killing.
Are there any vigilants in this kind of weather?
Well, there's me and Ward and a few people that I can't tell because they're not up here at the yellow line with us. So I can't tell. They're way back, and evidently they didn't want to be up here. So I don't know.
Okay. Well, Pat, thank you very much for your report, and I will go on and inform the audience that when the media and the witnesses cross the road, that means that Anthony is strapped to the gurney. The needles are in his veins, wherever they may be. In some places, it has to be exceptional places, but probably Anthony got them directly in the veins. And later on in this show, you will hear an interview with Anthony Shore, made prior to this sad occasion. Thank you,
from
Pat.
What I understand, there's no Supreme Court pending or anything. So, unfortunately, Jason Clark will be able to walk out about 6:20 and beat his chest like he's done something good.
But thank you very much for your report, and thank you for your loyalty to this issue.
You're welcome. See you later. Bye-bye.
Okay, Elizabeth, we have another line. Who's waiting for me there? Hello? Leah?
Oh, I'm here. Yes. Hi.
Okay. Leia, you are now on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. Can you tell us who you are?
Yes. I'm a very good friend of Anthony Shore's, and he calls me his goddaughter, and he is very much family to me, and he means the world, and this is very difficult.
Well, at this point, the process begins, and as far as we know here,
Yes.
It's unstoppable at this point. And
I'm aware.
I am not going to be the crass journalist that asks you how you feel. I'm going to be the crass journalist that asks you, how did you come to know Anthony?
I'm against the death penalty, and I had just written him a letter and not really expected very much out of it. And he ended up becoming one of my best friends I've ever had, and extremely dear to me, and he's always been there for me. And, yeah, I wish I could do more for him. I really wish I could have done more to stop this.
I've spent about 40 minutes with Anthony. 20 minutes of that will be in this broadcast called The Interview.
Yes.
And the interview has not been edited in any way. I have not taken a word out of it or added a word to it. That's my commitment to the fellows. And Anthony's interview was one that I kept waiting for a knock on the door from the other side, because Anthony was quite forthcoming in that interview.
Right.
And I was afraid that I had made an interview that might be used against him in a last-minute appeal or something, but that knock never came, and the issue is dead as of tonight.
It is.
It will go up on the it will be broadcast during this program, so it'll be on the KPFT archive as soon as the program is over. And then it will be integrated into a film of this show and shown on Houston Media Source, and that'll take a couple of weeks to get it spliced in. But those people who listen to this show can actually see Anthony responding to my questions in that interview. And that's kind of a memory.
Yes, yeah, I know he very much enjoyed sitting with you and meeting with you, and
no, Anthony and I got along very well, actually.
Right.
I found him to be intelligent. I found him to be more forthcoming than most of the interviews that I do. And,
right.
And he was certainly a likable guy. I have a theory that we never execute the person that did the crime, and I don't doubt that that's not true in Anthony's case.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. He is definitely not the same person.
Anthony may be a little different, because he was somebody else before the period of time where the crimes happened, and then he was a person when those were happening, and now he is somebody else again, and that's one of the great failings of execution system.
It is, and I will say, though, is he's at peace. He's ready to roll out of here, as he said, and he's okay, and he has some regrets and some things he wishes were different, but he's okay with this going through. He knew that this day would come, and he made his peace with it.
Well, thank you very much for being part of Execution Watch.
Absolutely. Thank you, and take care.
Okay. Mike, you've taken the lead in this case. This is a complex case. Pull that microphone down a little bit.
The case isn't
complicated. No, move the microphone. You're fine.
The case isn't complicated. Human nature is complicated. The case is simple. He killed and raped people. But let's talk about him as a person.
Okay.
He was born in 62. His father was in the Air Force. He was a military brat. He spent most of his life going from base to base with his family. He had two sisters. At one time in his life, he was considered to be a musical prodigy. At 5 years old, he gave a concert of classical music that was written up in the newspaper. I think it was Mozart that he memorized and was able to play. Did well in school, got along with people. By all accounts, he was very intelligent. Seemed like his life changed when his mother and father got a divorce. Seemed like after his mother and father left, seemed like it was a violent situation. His mother hit his father with a beer stein, and his father beat the mother up. Ever since that time, he always tried to impress his father. He started doing bad things real early. We have found out now that it seems like he used to brag that in high school that him and his friends murdered a homeless man. They just beat him to death. His sister, and by the way, I'm telling you things now that were not unknown to Harris County DA's office. What the sister says now, she told the DA's office way before they knew about him. She told them that when he was a kid, that he used to take her to the bus stop with him to pick up girls. That he brought her along because the girls would feel safe because he was with his sister. And then he would give him rides and get rid of the sister, and she knew he was molesting these girls. She also stated that he would find girls in the neighborhood he liked and have her go to the door and knock on the door and ask the girl, when the girl answered, he'd molest them. This is his sister who could see that he was molesting girls, felt guilty because he made a part of it, and he confessed that he had killed people. Throughout all this, he kept no police attention. He started moving to Houston.
How old was he when these things were going?
He was young, in high school. In high school. They don't talk what age, but it was when he was in high school or junior high school when he was doing these things. I'm assuming high school because he was having sex, not junior high school.
16, 17, 18.
Yeah, I'm assuming. It doesn't say the ages in my material, but he was picking up girls, driving cars at bus stops. So he had to be 16, 17.
And he had a younger sister that he used in the process.
And take her with him. And as she said, she realized now that he used her to make the girls feel comfortable that he was safe. So they would go with him. But every time, as soon as a girl got in the car, he would say, oh, you got to go that place and drop her off someplace and go with the girls. And she said she knew what he was doing, but didn't know what to do about it. Now, after that, he moves to Houston. We don't know how many people he might have kidnapped and raped, but by all accounts, he was very charismatic. He was very good-looking. He had a lot of girlfriends. By all accounts, he was never not in female company. Why he would want to go out and pick up girls to rape, but that's what he did for a hobby. He drove the neighborhoods. He picked up girls walking. He picked up girls bus stops. He cruised bus stations in the streets to pick up stray girls. Every one of these women that we know that he did this to were people walking in the street. Now, what's interesting on this case is that we don't know what he did. We know one that he did. Every other one is ones that he said he did. The one we know about was one in 92.
Wait a minute. I have said about this case in the build-up to doing the show that Anthony Shore may well have been who we accused Henry Lee Lucas of being, but all we knew about Henry Lee Lucas's crimes were what Henry told us about.
Same thing with this.
And that proved to be BS.
Same thing with this.
And so this great criminal history is from his telling us.
And let's get into what happened. In 86, he killed his first girl. And this was a girl he did not rape. He just killed her. He had picked her up in the car. He tried to have sex with her. She wanted to cooperate, so he killed her. But he didn't rape her. In 92, he picked up another woman, and this one he had sex with, and he did rape and kill.
According to him.
According to him. The 92 one went unsolved until 2003. Now, in the meantime, according to him, he did other murders, other kidnappings, but he was not known to authorities. He first became known to authorities in 1997 when he was arrested for having sex with his two daughters. Now, before he was arrested for having sex with his two daughters, let's backtrack a little bit. He had gotten married. He had two daughters. His wife left him. He had another. He got custody of both kids. I find it unusual the wife left him and left him with two kids. That woman will not talk to the authorities, will not talk to the press, but people feel that she's petrified of him. She left him with the two girls. In 97, he was arrested for having sex with these two girls. Before 97, two members of his family, his sister and his mother, suspected he was having sex with his daughters and called CPS on two different occasions to investigate him. And CPS did nothing. Nothing. They then called CPS to investigate why kids had no food and why they're locked up in the house with nobody seeing them. Again, CPS doesn't even come out to the house. So,
97. Pretty frustrating stuff.
97. What's frustrating is he's finally, what happened was he sent his daughters to his mother's house to live because he had a new girlfriend, and his mother and sister finally got the girls to say what he was doing, and then they went to the authorities and they turned him in.
So he had a case.
He had a case of having sex with his two daughters. Now, in my life, I've had many cases, not many, I've had my share of cases of men having sex with their daughters. He got a deferred adjudication. That shocks me. It was reduced to an indecency. How do you get indecency on rape of your two daughters?
How old were they?
There's no evidence of what I'm reading of the age, but I'm going to say one was 9 and one was a little bit older than 9.
Okay.
Okay.
How do you do? You're right. How the hell do you get?
I also don't understand that
a reduced charge, deferred adjudication.
More than that, while he's being prosecuted, his sister is calling up the DA's office in Harris County and telling them what he used to do with her when they were kids at bus stops and knocking on people's door. The sister who turned him in for having sex with his daughters is telling the DA's office that he used to pick up girls and do this when they were kids. And they give him deferred adjudication?
Well, that's good lawyering on the defense side.
I don't think it's good lawyering at all. I there was no talk in anything I've read that he hired a lawyer, that he money hired a lawyer. I'm assuming it was a court-appointed lawyer. What I read between the lines, that the witnesses lived in California. And because they lived in California, the DAs, it was out of sight, out of mind, and they basically got a deal to get rid of the case. Once he got on probation, deferred adjudication, he failed numerous drug tests and never got revoked. Now, this shocks me as a defense lawyer, but let me tell you what shocks me more. Let's go back to when he got arrested on his case. He's now with another woman. And the police come to his house. As she says, one day 14 homicide detectives show up to talk to him about what happened was because he was on probation, they took a DNA sample. The DNA sample, again, in competency with the Harris County Lab, the DNA sample was taken in 1997. Not till 2003 did they even take it away to be tested. 11 years after the murder, they get a hit that he was the one who killed the second victim in 92.
So they're lacing this together after the fact.
11 years later.
Let's stop right there and let's hear from Anthony. Here's my interview taped earlier with Anthony Shore on the visit room in Death Row in Livingston. You ready, Bob? Okay, let's hear that interview.
What you want to talk about today?
Well, if everybody's hearing this, then I'm assuming that at this point in time, I'm passing into the next world, that I've left this plane and my execution is in progress. Right now.
But if you get a stay...
Is that basically correct?
That's exactly correct. If you get a stay...
Right.
And they dispose of your case without killing you, I'll be back to ask you if I can use the tape.
Okay.
But otherwise, the only time this will be taped is during Execution Rights Program,
right,
where you were being executed.
Well, then I'd like to talk about what's important. And to me, I've come to realize, especially in the last few days... You know, it puts things in a different perspective when you're facing your impending demise, that many of the things that you think are important in life become a lot less important. You know, material things and activities and the people that you sometimes think are, you know, top of the list really aren't who you thought they were. A lot of things change. But what becomes important to me is love. And I believe above and beyond all other things. For me, God, or my interpretation of God, is love incarnate. He encompasses everything that has to do with love. And I don't think there's any greater love in this lifetime than children, your own kids. And I've got two out there, Amber and Tiffany. What I'd like to talk about is have an opportunity to say goodbye, to tell my girls, both Amber and Tiffany, and my grandkids, Floyd and Aphrodite, goodbye. I wish I'd had time to meet them in person, to speak with them. I wish I had an opportunity to speak with my daughters face to face and tell them that I love them and you know, I messed up. I'm not nearly the daddy I should have been when I could have been. There are no do-overs in life. But the one thing I would leave everybody with is this, that you only get one opportunity to show your love and tell people that you really care about them in life. And really, people are defined by their actions. Well, I have done a lot of good things in my life, but I've also done a lot of bad things. Probably the hardest thing in life is to forgive oneself. Forgiving others is pretty hard, believe me, I know. But to forgive yourself is a hard road to hoe, and I finally have come to the point where I've reached that peace in myself. And so what I would want to do is say to the people that I've hurt, to the victims' families and loved ones, that I can't undo the damage that I did, but I would give anything to be able to do over, to do my life over and start from the beginning and not make some of the poor choices that I made along the way, because I can only imagine their pain and loss, because I've got kids of my own, and everybody loses, you know, everybody's as a mother and a father or a child, you know. So,
do you know where your kids are now?
Yes, I do. Well, I know where one of them is for sure. I don't know for sure on the other one. But
so this may be the only communication you have with them.
This may be the last opportunity. So anybody hearing this show, you know, there's possibly hundreds of thousands out there who may actually listen or get a copy of this. If you have the means to reach out to either of my daughters, tell them, I'm sorry, I wish I'd been there for them when I should have been, and that I love them. And nothing will ever change that. Nothing. Nothing could ever be close to how I feel about that. Everyone else who has shown me love and consideration in these last 14 years, especially during my incarceration, but most especially in the last few years, you know who you are. I love you as well. And I just want to say goodbye. I don't want anyone to cry on my behalf. If anything, throw a party. I even wrote a poem about it. But long story. I wish I could. I'm going to write to the station. I'll give you a copy. I can't recite it verbatim.
Sure, no. I mean, I'd like a copy.
The basic gist is that dying's easy. Dying is the easiest thing any of us get to do. Everybody has a death sentence.
Everybody gets a shot at it.
Everybody's got a death sentence. We're all born into it, this world with one. It's living that's hard along the way. As I say, one thing I learned back here on death row, especially living around what people consider to be the worst of the worst, the condemned men, because they're supposedly dysfunctional in society, or at least we've been labeled that way, is that I found that they're people like everybody else. They're human beings. There's been a lot of compassion and a lot of amazing things that I've witnessed with my own eyes. Men that have given of themselves their time and energy for other people and become part of a society. It's not the same society outside the walls as it is back here, but it is a society here where there's a lot of compassion and civility, and it's really surprising. It's opened my eyes to a whole different reality. And I have to say that the incarceration, though perhaps not a life that I would choose for anyone, it's actually been a very good life to me, surprisingly. I've been blessed more than most people probably, and it has a lot to do with the kindness and love that people have shown me since I've been here. Again, I want to extend my love and consideration to those people as well when I say goodbye to all of the people. You know who you are. There's too many to list by name.
Well, most of your inner circle, support circle, probably going to see the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, the people that have supported you through this journey are probably regular watchers and listeners of my show.
Could be. Some of them are, I know, for sure.
I get a lot of mothers.
Yeah.
And people that visit on a regular basis. You know what the mothers tell me?
Mm.
They tell me thank you for their laughter.
Mm-hmm.
because a mother traipsing up to visit her son through this glass on this phone doesn't get a lot of laughter.
Sure.
Usually when they're out with Uncle Ray, we let her hair down. Well, you ain't got any hair to let down. But I'd catch a smile, or I can get a laugh. And those mothers appreciate that laughter because they haven't seen it in somebody that they love who is now gone.
Let me ask one other thing.
Sure.
I had a song that was played on the prison show recently.
Sure.
Funk It Up by St. Vitus Dance. That was,
uh-huh.
that was a band that I was in for several years back
really?
In the 90s.
You a musician guy?
Yeah, musician.
You
I was
play
a
acts?
Keyboardist.
Keyboardist, okay.
And I'd like to have that played as part of this show as well.
We'll do the best we can.
If you could include that as part of the...
Yeah, my job is to be the host.
Right.
I got a producer that I deal with, and she is tough. She's not with me today, but if she is here, she'd have a whip and a chair.
Right.
But yeah. I'll pitch it. What's the title of the song again?
Funk It Up.
Funk It Up?
You have the CD at the station.
Okay.
It's already loaded into your archive, so it's...
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
It would be cool if y'all could play that on my way out as well, since the basic gist of the poem that I wrote when I first got to Death Row, and it still applies today, is that, there should be a rockin' band. Dying is easy. It's living that's hard. Everyone gets a one-way card. So when I'm dead and on my way, tomorrow's just another day. And it is for all of us. Really, and I know this is kind of short for the interview that you had intended, but that's about all I've got to say.
That's all I got to say. Well, let me just a couple of questions.
Sure.
You mentioned something about the society on death row, a kind of mutual support.
Okay.
Are there any barriers to that? Racial barriers or belief barriers?
The barriers that I have witnessed and come across have more to do with the choices that people make. People, again, they focus on the wrong things sometimes. Instead of focusing on the beauty that is to be had in every day, I mean, it could be something as simple as a little flower trying to, or weed, you know, creeping up through the crack in the sidewalk, or the black widow spiders that we had as pets out there on the rec yard. Yeah, you know, feed them little flies that you catch and this and that. There's little things that you see, or maybe a bird, you know, that lands. It's really beautiful that you don't see all the time, a cardinal or something. There's little things that are beautiful. God's everywhere. He's in everything. And there's a rhythm or a music to life in itself. And I believe that a lot of people, instead of choosing to find joy and hold on to that moment, instead, they focus on, oh, we're going to be locked down, and the anxiety
of
something. Well, the anxiety of something that hasn't even happened yet. We're getting ready to be locked down. Okay, well, this is something that's going on right here and now. As an example, it could have happened yesterday. It might have happened today. It could happen while I'm out here, or it might happen tomorrow. But people are already getting all hung up on that. They're getting, and these are the barriers to having equality in the society. It's more about the choices instead of focusing on, well, you know what? I just got a beautiful letter from somebody, or I had an inspiring thought. Instead, they're focusing on, oh, man, you know, maybe we're going to go on lockdown or this and that, and it's going to interfere with this. But the point is, that's anxiety. That hasn't happened yet, so why spend your time worrying about things like that? If you can take and find joy in the moment that you're living, and then the next moment, and the moment after that, and string together a few moments of joy, then you've got a real good quality of life, no matter
where
you are.
But tell me, that applies to everybody. You don't
have to be on
the road to find that.
Right. And that's my point, that even though we live back here on death row or behind these walls, there's still a quality of life to be had that is beautiful, that people don't see because they think that all it is about all of the chaos and despair. I'm not saying there isn't a lot of chaos and despair, but I'm saying that ultimately it has to do with the choices you make. I make good choices. I don't know that everyone does. I'm really sad, and I pray for the people that don't make good choices. This is something that has been a revelation since I've been incarcerated, because obviously in the free world, I didn't make a lot of good choices or I wouldn't be here in the first place talking to you. Does that make sense?
Well, I'm still hung back on the metaphor of the little flower struggling to take root in the crack in the concrete.
Right.
It comes up and blooms.
Mm-hmm.
That's a wonderful picture.
It happens.
And I thank you for giving that to me and to my audience.
Good.
I wish you the very best of luck. I hope you get a stay. I hope I don't do this show. But if I do, folks are not going to forget you soon.
Know this. I would love to get a stay, Ray. I would. That would be awesome. But at the same time, I'm ready for what happens next. It's kind of like when you get to the front of the line at the roller coaster ride. There's the trepidation of getting there and standing in line. But when you get to the front of the line, excuse me, and I'm kind of there, I'm sort of at the front of the line, I'm excited to find out what happens next. We're all going to get there. We're all going to be at the front of that line at some point. Most of us don't have the privilege of knowing when it's going to happen, so they don't prepare. I've had time to prepare and think about this.
It's interestingly put. I'm going to end the interview here.
Okay.
It's a wonderful line.
All right. Give my love to all, and especially for those out there listening, if you can reach out to my kids and just let them know I love them. I do.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mike, which of the laundry list of murders is he being executed for?
The second one. He's being murdered for the one that they found the DNA under the fingernails of the person who was deceased. That's the one in which they got his DNA.
That's 1992.
The 1992 case. He was 29 at the time.
Get to the microphone. 1992.
He was 29 at the time.
And they discovered the DNA in 2000.
2003, 11 years later.
Okay,
they only asked for it to be sent away in 2000.
That is the case that he's being executed
for. That is the case.
Tonight.
The interesting part is that the other confessions that he gave on these other girls, when the police came about this one case, I question if he would have not said anything, would he have gotten a death penalty? But when they came, he basically said, "What took you so long?" and started talking about all these other victims. Now, the interesting thing...
That's not to say what took you so long is not a valid question.
Of course. But what's interesting to me is that I criticized the Harris County DA's office for taking so long to run the DNA sample. But if they would have run it when the murder happened, his database would not have been... His DNA would not have been in the database. It would have come back clear. Because it took so long, they caught him. Now... The other interesting aspect of it to me is since that time, he's made numerous confessions of killing other people.
As a matter of fact, he got the stay we were talking about during the interview because he was willing to volunteer Swearingen in Swearingen's case.
And since that time, he's volunteered on two more murders. I question, and I don't question he's done the murders. I think he did. But... There's been no proof that he did the other two murders besides him saying it. The truth of the matter, he's on death row.
The rest of it is jawbone. It's
because what he said, which gets to be interesting because during the trial, the only victim that lived, and according to testimony, he was trying to prove to her that he did not have to kill. And she lived because he went through a dialogue of, "I don't have to kill. I'm trying to change. I don't have to kill."
Paige, do you have any idea where we're going to go with this case?
Well, the dialogue you're talking about is a sort of self-internal dialogue that he supposedly experienced at the scene involving the first girl that we're talking about, the first victim. The facts of the case were undisputed, and a lot of the reason that the facts of the case were undisputed is because he admitted everything in his confession, and the detectives that were involved in taking the confession, there were four different detectives, and he... the entire process of the confession is exquisitely detailed, and he received potty breaks, he received food and water, and the entire process of the confession, every time he said he wanted to stop, they stopped. He was warned about his rights to an attorney, and he waived them. And it just, it was very, very well, it was very, very well investigated at the time.
The witnesses have left the Walls building in Huntsville and returned to the administration building across 12th Street. At this point, Anthony Shore is dead. They will give his body over to the vendor that transports death row inmates after they have died. If there is any family or friend request that the body be available for a viewing before it leaves Huntsville, it will go to a small church in the neighborhood, wrapped only in a sheet, and they will be able to touch the body while it is still warm. I'm sorry that that is such a morbid ritual, but we deal with morbid things here on this show, and that's what happens to bodies of the deceased in Huntsville after they are executed. Anthony Shore is dead. What we have on him is mostly an autobiography written in great detail. And I can imagine the room with the detectives doing the interview for the confession. Detectives can get quite excited around a good confession. It's an adrenaline and excitement producing event for them. If you don't believe me, then there's a great movie called Confession. It has Lee J. Cobb as the detective and Brandon DeWilde as the confessor. I suggest you watch that movie. I watched it several times because I think Lee J. Cobb and Brandon DeWilde are both handsome.
I'll go with Brandon DeWilde.
Nobody appreciates older men.
No, that's not true. Be all that as it may. In any event, the confession process was, like I said before, exquisitely detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave his confession to his choice of detective. He was interviewed during the confessory period by four different detectives. And when he got tired of one, he took a potty break and got coffee. And
brought in another one. He wore them out.
It was like he requested his next detective. And he ended up giving his confession to the detective of his choice.
Jack, do you have anything sage to add to this scene?
Well, sage is... Sage is a tricky proposition for me.
It's an earth.
This is not a usual case.
No. I mean, and, you know, there's so many... If you look at the appeal in 2007, so many issues came up, and the issues were all... he wasn't availed to this... mitigating evidence, the confession was bad, and so on and so forth. But really, Shore wanted to turn himself in. Shore simply decided that it was simply a matter of time as to when he was going to get caught for his past acts.
And he took some pride in having some control over that.
Sure. And it seems to me that this is a situation where he simply, he knew that eventually this was all going to catch up with him. If you look at the appeal, he talks about, one of the things that his attorneys, appealed on issues were that the confessions were bad. But as Paige said, he pretty much solicited his next confessor.
He's inquisitors.
Yeah, he solicited his next confessor.
He did pick his next
sure. So wait a minute. You're talking about a guy that even in handcuffs and under the lights had considerable control of his destiny, and
I think he had absolute control over it. And I think that's how he wanted it.
I agree. I truly believe that this was what he wanted to do, the way he wanted to do it, and it was very important to him that he be able to orchestrate everything involved in his confession. After his arrest, in his trial, one of the reasons he declined to present a defense, either at guilt or innocence or at punishment, was that he wanted that sort of control over his entire future. He picked it out that way.
Jack, get close to the microphone. I don't think we've ever had a case like this before.
Well, what's interesting,
get close to the microphone.
What's interesting to me is, according to his sisters, he was fixated on pleasing his father. And all of these things with the confessions with the police officer goes back to the same situation of pleasing his father. The fact that the three victims that he confessed to are all victims that he left the bodies out, one at a restaurant, one at a Dairy Queen, and the third in the field, and when they didn't find it quick enough, he called up to give a hint to where they found the body. He wanted it to be found. He wanted to control it. And the control issue is real important, because he didn't just kill him. He used a tourniquet on the neck with a piece of wood so he could slowly control the amount of blood. It's control. He could control the death of the person more delicately with a stick.
Larry, why isn't this the most macabre case we've done?
I'm not sure that it's not. The thing that stands out about well, a couple of things first, clear up some things. Our system's not perfect.
No.
But it's a really, really good system. And the Harris County DA's office does a good job in association with law enforcement. But a lot of things change over the years, I mean, from 1986 to 2003.
This would be a capital case if it happened tomorrow.
Well, I'm talking about just the technology, the DNA.
Yeah.
Okay. The capability of what to do with DNA has changed a lot. But the thing that stands out to me, particularly from listening to the interview of Anthony Shure, the word control just keeps coming up over and over. He did control his confession, and he seemed to be pretty much in control of the interview. There were some things he wanted to get out. And Mike mentioned control over.
He pretty much controlled the interview I had with him.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And controlling the
I had to say, wait a minute, I got a couple of questions here.
Yeah.
And he gave me a little of the overtime.
And then even the anonymous call that was made to the TV station saying there's a serial killer out there. He was controlling the media to some extent. But in terms of how we do things, both from the prosecutor's perspective and the defense perspective, I'm not real surprised at the fact that he got deferred adjudication for the sexual assault of his own daughters. I mean, there are a lot of factors that go into how a case is resolved.
Yeah.
And deferred adjudication is not the greatest thing in the world. I mean, some prosecutors refer to that as
No. I would rather have a straight probation than a deferred adjudication, but then I've already got a felony conviction, so what the hell difference does it make?
Well, I've heard prosecutors refer to deferred adjudication as a layaway plan. So we're going to lay this time away for him. He's going to come back and get it. But you resolve cases. I mean, the resolution of cases just boggles the mind sometimes is how it happened, because things just change so much in terms of what's available, what witnesses available, and so forth. But there was just an overwhelming amount of evidence, much of which he provided against himself.
Yeah, but the trouble with him providing his own evidence, it's like the Henry Lee Lucas problem again. How the hell do we know that's not a figment of his imagination?
The details? The details that
he's only tried on one case.
I understand that, but the details of, oh, by the way, you find this body, take 15 steps in this direction, and then another 12 steps in this direction, and then right behind the tree, you look over here, and there's going to be a cigarette pack right in front of you, and 15 paces north of that.
Well, Henry Lee was actually an artist, and they gave him part of the picture. He just was able to mentally complete it.
I understand that.
But there is no question.
And in
you
this
can
case,
kill somebody in Broward County, and you killed somebody in Harris County. 20 minutes later, you need Star Trek to do that.
Or the government.
You think we can move him in 20 minutes?
But that's not what happened in this case, though,
no,
right?
That's
okay.
Not what
and then in this case, there was considerable amount of detail given by him. And trust me, law enforcement did go out and evaluate that and determine before they used it. I mean, otherwise, the lawyers would have been all
but
over them.
They didn't try those cases. They just tried one case.
Yeah,
they didn't need to.
They don't
and
need
there
to.
Was
they didn't
no
need
defense.
To. Mike, they didn't need to.
I mean, you can only
but there
execute
was,
a person
wait,
once.
Wait a minute. We can only talk one at a time. It works better in television if you do that. There was no defense presented.
I'm talking about the ones
in the case that was tried.
Right. That one I'm not, but the other ones he just talked about, I did not see they did any checking of the details. They just assumed
they
told the truth.
I mean, the one where he called in KPRC and said, oh, by the way, you have a serial killer here.
And this
way, nobody is,
details.
And as
they don't know it was him, they think
nobody has said this is a Montrose case.
The killing that he was charged for happened around the corner from my house.
He tells you they tell you exactly where the body is.
But no, who?
He tells KPRC.
We think he was the one who called. Nobody knows if he's the one
that called. Then
afterwards he confesses and tells you where it is.
I'm interested in this Portsmouth address.
Yeah. That's 1900 block of Portsmouth.
1900 block. I know where the 1900 block is.
That's the girl who lived. She was a telephone repairman. He stalked her, and he broke into her house. He raped her, but he tried to prove to her that he's not a killer. He's told her that he's not going to kill her because he's trying to prove he's not a killer. I think the control is the issue. His wife said that he liked to control sex by making them, choking them out so they're unconscious, have sex with them.
Yeah, well,
he's a control freak.
I know state representatives have committed suicide
that way. I question sometimes whether or not the fact that he felt so bad about killing these people, did he mean to kill them or mean to rape them? Was he choking them out to put them unconscious, have sex with them, and then they died by accident?
No.
Tripped and accidentally strangled themselves with a pencil.
Anthony Shore basically told us who he was. And if you're listening to this on the radio, I would suggest you go to the extra step and in a couple of weeks go to Houston Media Source. If you've got cable, that's Channel 17 Comcast. If you don't have cable, you can get that on HMS.
I
want to
bring
TV.
One more thing before we run out of time.
Sure.
What I find is fascinating how smart this guy is. What does anybody have any comment about the amount of paintings that is being sold on the internet after his death? That there is a moneymaker scenario out there where he's drawing pictures and poems and selling them on the internet, and there's a broker out there who claims that he has a whole lot of his drawings
material
that's going to flood the market after tonight. What a brilliant idea, using all of these
things. For
somebody else.
For basically...
Not hanging on my mantle.
Basically, he can't sell that under a Texas law until after he's been executed. Then somebody else can sell
it. And that's what somebody is doing right now. But he was smart enough to know that.
Check your eBay catalog. And my name is Ray Hill, and what you've been listening to for the last hour is a program about the death of Anthony Shore, who was executed tonight by the state of Texas. Anthony had a few friends show up to support him in Huntsville. And to put this show together, we have the following wonderful cast. The lawyers are Michael Gillespie, who had lead in this case, Jack Lee, Paige Yannick, and, of course, the voice of God himself. Larry. Larry Douglas is a wonderful asset to this program, and God, I wish someone had given me a voice like that. By the way, he's available for voiceovers at a small fee if you just look him up in the bar guide. We couldn't do this show without our executive producer, who is Elizabeth Stein. And Elizabeth Stein is glaring at us through the window because I'm a little bit ahead of schedule, and she worries about those things. Otis McClay is our technical producer, and he is the guy who has put that on the internet for you tonight and on KPFT's stream, and we'll have the archive on the website in a couple of days. Our engineer in the studio is Bob Gardner. Thank you, Bob, for your committed work. We are all, the lawyers are criminal defense lawyers, and they deal with these kind of cases not quite this serious on a day-to-day basis in the courthouse. In other words, they're charged with trying to protect people who are freedom, and they don't get to choose whether or not their clients are guilty or innocent, because even a werewolf is entitled to an adequate representative. Who'd said that? William O. Douglas? It sounds like an O. Douglas quote. Even a werewolf is entitled to an adequate defense, and they try to do that work in the courthouse every day. And Jack even comes from Channelview, where things can get even more ignitable. And I grew up in Cloverleaf, which is next door, which is a little bit downwind from Channelview, and so all the males in my neighborhood were required to go to prison, and I fulfilled my duty in 1970, and then I got out and did the prison show for all those years, and I do this show now. We are scheduled to do an execution on January the 30th. We always hope for a stay, but William Rayford is scheduled to be executed on that date. And William Rayford, reading over his case in advance, is someone who is going to have a stay. And then next month, we're going to have a show about the execution of a fellow by the name of Battaglia from Dallas. And it was another kill your own children cases. And so we're going to get these almost back to back. Battaglia is probably listening to the show. He's a faithful listener to the show. And my interview with Battaglia was one of the most entertaining interviews that I've ever done. We talked about everything but the case. And but you will hear his voice in an interview in that show, and therefore there will be cameras in the studio to do this show. We could not do this show if it were not for the freedom that is afforded KPFT by its listener sponsors. We could not take programming from this radio station and turn it into television if it were not for Houston Media Source. And shooting tonight for Houston Media Source is Roger Palomino, who is a staff member over there. Our usual Mark Pirtle, who shot the interview in prison, had other responsibilities, and I want to thank Roger and Mark for giving us the visual. My name is Ray Hill. We killed somebody tonight. His name's Anthony Shore. It was done in the name of and at the direct orders of the citizens of the state of Texas. The music we're going to go out with is from Victoria Panetti. Her brother is a mentally damaged person sitting on death row awaiting his turn in Texas. Good night. Most don't.
you know they're killing.